Okay, so hello and welcome, Sebastian,
Thanks for having me.
to the new CCG podcast episode. And I'm actually really exciting that we're going to talk about neurodiversity today in all its aspects, because I was not really aware of this topic until you started to talk about it. In our last CCG masterclass, it was great. So we got to know each other through the CCG masterclass, also through a friend who did the masterclass recommended you. So it was a very nice way of meeting you. And when I looked at your LinkedIn profile, you say you are Austria's first and only, brackets for now, neurodiversity coach and consultant. And you are a movement therapist and you are a systemic coach as well. And
Yeah,
I guess
that's right.
more things. You are dancer, as you said, as well, a choreographist. But the topic of today is basically focused around neurodiversity. And we will explore the question about what is neurodiversity? What is neuroinclusion? What are the different terms? Why does it matter? What happens if people are not aware of this? And then we will focus in this specific episode on the relevance for businesses and organizations. Because what I've seen, it's mostly about in the context of education and children. But I think for us today, the topic is more the business relevance for organizations and what that really means for employees, for culture, for the context. But let's start super simple with the first question. When people talk about neurodiversity, what are they talking about? What does that even mean?
Yes, thank you. So neurodiversity is a term that developed in the late 90s. It comes from a sociologist called Julie Singer. And Julie Singer, I think she had family members who had Asperger's, and were quite high functioning, but they were definitely differently wired in one way or another. And she coined this term neurodiversity, which actually I wouldn't say is a new, it wasn't a new concept at the time. It's been around for a long, long, long time. I mean, there's even discussions that people say Aristotle was talking about, what's the difference between a normal difference in cognition and a disorder. But anyway, so Judy Singer's hypothesis or her idea was that a lot of the things that we call disorders are essentially differences in cognition. They're differences in how we perceive, how we process information, and how we interact sort of on a brain level. And her idea was that rather than seeing this as like a medical problem, to see it as part of the normal variation in human diversity. So we have different skin colors, we have different colors of eyes, we have different ways our metabolism works. We have all these different things that we consider totally like just part of the spectrum of humanity. And what if differences in how the brain work are included in that? So that's the basic origin of the term. And I think it's a good, yeah, I think it's a good starting point to work with the term.
They have a one question because you say, isn't it so that anyway every brain and every person works differently? So where does it start to be neurodiverse or out of the norm? Do we have an idea what that even means or why that's interesting?
Right, yeah, so that's a very good question. Just one thing to point out to begin answering that question is the term neurodiversity encompasses like the whole of the variation from what we'd say is neurotypical, which is kind of quite a normal brain. I put it in like rabbit ears, a normal brain, to a neurodivergent brain. And so I think a good way to think about it is certainly that there's a continuum of I don't think there's a hard cutoff of this person's neurotypical, this person's neurodivergent. I think there's certainly a softer gradation there. And then when it gets into sort of the extreme ends, then you could say the advantages of being neurodivergent will start to be outweighed by the disadvantages when it gets very extreme, in terms of how you live a life, how you exist in the world, how you, you know, have an income, have a livelihood, all that kind of stuff. So at some point in the extremes, it starts to get medicalized more, let's say.
Oh, right. So let's stick maybe with the ones that are more typical. Like, what are maybe just some of the main kinds of neurodivergence that people typically would talk about that we can relate to, that we maybe know and that have some like also practical meaning for us?
Right. Okay. So the main ones, I call them the big three, which are dyslexia, attention hyperactivity deficit disorder, ADHD, and no, sorry, attention deficit and hyperactivity disorder, and autism spectrum. So those are the big three. There's also a whole load of them, which I won't go into, but like, and some are more debated, things like sensory processing disorder, dyspraxia, there's some stuff that's like a bit more sort of, it's a bit more argued about. Like some people say bipolar disorder is a form of neurodiversity, and it's like, well, yeah, it's not neurotypical. But I think one thing to sort of highlight is that part of the idea of neurodiversity includes that there's an advantage on some level, that evolution has selected these divergences. Whereas things like, I don't know, bipolar disorder, it's like, it's not clear what the advantage of that might be. So I can see, yeah, those are the ones that are kind of debated, but I'd say the big three, which I think probably I'll sort of focus the rest of what I say around, would be dyslexia, ADHD, and autism spectrum disorder.
So we're not talking here about like other pathologies like sociopaths or narcissistic disorders or things like this. So we're more looking at this spectrum. It really gets a little bit tricky, right?
Yeah, it does. It does.
we are all not psychiatrists.
Yeah, exactly. Also on things like personality disorders, there's a difference made in psychopathology between a sort of an like a brain, a difference in brain functioning and a personality. Just anyway, it gets very, very, very complicated.
We're now talking about the brain functioning specifically, right? Yeah.
Yeah.
I think that makes sense and makes it also clearer for me, because there's so much that we are all now pseudo clinical psychologists and therapists. Everybody suddenly talks about trauma and talks about sociopaths, talks about narcissists and all of that. And actually, we don't really know what we're basically talking about.
Yeah. I'm actually doing the psychotherapy Propedeutikum at the minute, to the training in Austria to become a psychotherapist.
Okay.
And the one of my teachers refers to Küchenpsychologie, which would translate into English as kitchen psychology.
Yeah. It's very big right now. I think therefore it really makes sense to be quite precise what we are basically talking about. And the question I have for you is why is that even a problem or an issue we should care about and we should talk about, and how is that relevant for businesses to know more about it?
Right. So I think sort of the bridge sort of from the topic in general to businesses is that, as you mentioned something, I can't remember if we were just chatting before we started or whether we started with it, but a lot of what we think of in terms of the kind of typical image of neurodivergence is usually we're thinking about kids. So if you think of someone who's dyslexic, you think of a child who's struggling at school to read and write. Or if you think of ADHD, you think of a child at school who's struggling to sit still, right?
Right.
And I think some of the more recent, partly the more recent research, but also the more recent communication of the science has been going more into how this is relevant for adults. And so something that's, I think, very relevant for dyslexia, for example, is like the brain, the basic underlying brain patterning doesn't go away even once you can read and write. So there's still a lot of difference in perceptual and perception and information processing in someone who's got adult dyslexia, which may not manifest as I can't read. It still may do, but it may not. And I think with ADHD and autism, it's maybe like the awareness of adult variations of it, or the adult version of that, is kind of a bit better known. But I think that's the first thing. This is like not something that just goes away through the course of your life. It's something that can get managed better. It's something that like the advantages can start to be more dominant than the challenges from it. But it's still the variation in the brain is still there.
Mm.
So the exact numbers are debated, but I think sort of I'd say there's a kind more or less a consensus that around 15% of the population is neurodivergent.
Mm-hmm.
So we're talking about 1 in 8 people.
Mm-hmm.
Some people say it's more. Some people say it's a bit less, but I think 1 in 8 is a fairly good ballpark. Certainly 1 in 10 is very safe to say. So if you run a business and you've got more than 8 people, then you've got someone neurodivergent in your team. And so then you scale that up. You know, we're talking about tens, hundreds, potentially thousands of employees who are neurodivergent. And the question then is, like, are you creating an environment in which these people can thrive, and which the advantages that they have in their neurodivergence can outweigh the disadvantages? And so I think that's a huge thing for attracting talent, retaining talent, and just getting the most out of them. I think it's kind of easy. It's easy to fall into a bit of like the kind of classic capitalist, how do we exploit the advantage kind of thing. But I think on another level, what I really care about is like neuroinclusion is really, well, can somebody feel like they're thriving in the place where they go to work, which is going to take a lot of their day, you know, a lot of their time.
Well, yeah, neuroinclusion is another term that we're going to explore a little bit more deeper. But before we go there, I'd like to make it a little bit more personal. I told you before that I was diagnosed with dyslexia when I was at school. At the beginning of the school, I had exactly those problems to learn reading and writing. And I had to do some extra classes in the afternoon for dyslexic children, specific training, but also general training, because I was really not good. And I felt like really stupid. I mean, it was just a stupid bad in school kid. So I had to like stay longer and do some extra trainings. I never ever considered this as maybe there's a talent to it. And as you say, till now, I'm probably dyslexic. As you say, once dyslexic, forever. I now can read and write, obviously, and I could do. I was very good in school later on. I could do. I was good in studying. I was never had problems in working, but still, there could be some challenges that I'm not even aware of that could make my life easier or more difficult if I had more awareness. So if I would come to you as my neurodiversity coach and say, well, I have adult dyslexia, what would you tell me what that means for me, and what kind of work environment would I specifically need to thrive?
So if you were to come to me as a client, then I mean, firstly, I would say it's difficult to make a very generalized sort of like, oh, you're dyslexic, here's a prescription of the things that you need, because there's a lot of nuance in how it expresses itself. So I think personalization is important. That said, I can tell you some of the general, some kind of more general points.
Yeah, I think
So
that works for the podcast.
So one of some of the main things are the dyslexic brain doesn't automate routine tasks very well. So the number of times it takes for something to become automatic is just more repetitions than the general population. So that would be things like when I was in my early 20s, I did a few trial shifts as a trying to work in a coffee shop. And it was kind of horrible because it'd be like trying to work the till, I'm trying to like do the coffees, I'm trying to do this, like rinse this thing, rinse that thing. And all of these things are things which, once you've achieved a degree of automaticity, then you just do them and you can chat to the customer as you do it. But it's very stressful if like you're feeling like everything that you're doing for the first time. And okay, they were trial shifts, so I was doing a lot of them for the first time. But the length of time it would take me to learn something like that, and I've seen this in other environments when I've been there for longer, it's just like you're doing things and it's like this is a completely new activity. And there's an advantage to this, right? So the advantage is that anything that requires mindfulness, anything that requires treating the situation as if it's new, you're great at. Because and especially I think things that are very people oriented, right? And things like coaching, you in coaching, it's great to be able to sort of say, okay, who is this person in front of me? And not just work from a protocol of like session one is this, session two is this, but bam, 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 bam. So that's one of the advantages of that. In general, there's some great work from Dr. Miguel Casanova. Maybe we can put some notes in the show notes about how
Yeah,
to find some of that stuff.
absolutely.
And his basic hypothesis is dyslexia is a lot about seeing the forest at the expense of the trees. So seeing big picture at the expense of patterns. And reading and writing is something, sorry, big picture at the expense of details. So reading and writing is something that really requires a lot of detailed differentiating between this shape, this sound. And yeah, it's not such a, it doesn't become a more big picture thing until you've mastered those very detail-oriented basics. So it's kind of thinking in like the big story arcs, but struggling with how to get the sentence down. And so anything where you're able to think in this big picture way, where there's a lot of room for novelty is good. The specific kind of, this gets more into the sort of subtypes, but there's subtypes of dyslexia that are really amazing with spatial thinking, can work three dimensionally very well. That's where you get like Richard Rogers and Norman Foster, who are both dyslexic, and they're the two most famous architects in the world. You get, some amazing engineers, carpenters, people who make things, and then you get other subtypes of dyslexia, which is more about sort of connecting distantly associated ideas, which is where actually this is where dyslexia and ADHD overlap, and then there's versions that are more about like narrative thinking, the art of thinking stories. So that would be a kind of general overview of potential dyslexic strengths. There's other models of dyslexic strengths. I'm sort of working mainly from one, which again put in the show notes, but yeah, I think that's the starting point of the kind of thing.
I think that's extremely interesting. Also thinking about like two parts when it comes to the relevance for business. The one is that I myself I get aware of this condition or this neurodiversity divergence I have, You said around 15% of people are neurodivergent, approximately. The question is, how many of those 15% are aware of that and what that even means for them? And then the second one is for organizations and companies and to be aware of that and facilitate and create an environment for exactly people with those neurodivergent talents or conditions, or however, what would be the best term, neurodivergencies. So both is quite complex. And I was wondering where we are right now in this awareness of those talents and possibilities connected to neurodivergence.
Yeah, that's a really good question as well. This is something that I think is different in different countries. So I come from the UK, but I live in Austria. In my childhood, I was in the German school system a little bit, and I was also in the English school system. So I have a kind of comparison of like the different cultures around it in the sort of more English speaking and the more German speaking world. And I think the English speaking world is really ahead of the game with it. Austria is very sort of, I'd say, behind the curve about it. The German speaking world in general, I think that's down to quite a few things. But when I was growing up, it was quite a good time in terms of there's quite good awareness of potential advantages of it. There was a lot of effort made to look at screening, you know, making sure that people got diagnosed, and if and when people got diagnosed, to give the label in a way that's as free of stigma as possible, and to sort of create a bit of a culture of like, hey, it's cool, look at this club we're in, you know, we're in this kind of strange brain club, go us. Whereas I think the German speaking world, there's still a lot more stigma attached to it. There's still a lot more, there's a lot more shame around it, essentially. So people don't go for diagnosis because they don't want the shame, associated with it, but then also don't get to see the advantages. I think the sort of where are we point is a very, it's got an aspect where it's quite cultural, but then I think what I'm seeing in the business world is that there's more and more of a mood of, this is the next level of diversity inclusion, diversity equity inclusion, and that it's being embraced. And there's, I think part of this is actually coming a lot from dyslexic founders of businesses. So you have people like Richard Branson, who's been saying for decades, I'm not successful despite my dyslexia, but because of it. You have, you know, people like the founder of IKEA, Steve Jobs, Bill Gates, who are all sort of, you know, all known as being neurodivergent, and are sort of coming out with a kind of neurodivergent and proud kind of attitude towards it. Maybe not them themselves, but like certainly the companies now. So the chief information officer of Google was dyslexic for a while, and also was really like, let's get neuro inclusion happening within Google. So I think some of these big, you know, these big players are actually some of the ones that are flying the flag for it most.
So they're dyslexic, but do we also have examples of ADHD or autism spectrum?
Because I'm personally dyslexic, I tend to get a bit over focused on it. In terms of ADHD,
yeah, I'm like me with my dyslexia,
yeah,
bias.
with ADHD and autism spectrum, there's not as an easy collection of stories to sort of go to and say, okay, this person. I think in show business, there's a lot more, you can sort of find actors, musicians with ADHD quite easily, like Jim Carrey, for example, has ADHD, and I think Whoopi Goldberg perhaps as well. I need to double check that. anyway, in terms of business, it's not so visible, let's say, and same with autism spectrum, but that doesn't mean it's not there. People with autism spectrum tend to be less the kind of founding a business types. Generally, I don't want to overgeneralize because I'm sure there's lots of exceptions to that. Dyslexia and ADHD both kind of come with a certain openness to risk, which autism spectrum doesn't quite seem to. Autism spectrum people tend to prefer predictability and sort of there being a bit more of a pattern. Not always, though. Temple Grandin's one of the big autism advocates. She's very interesting. I don't know so much about her, but I've flicked through some of her books, and what she says is very interesting. And she,
I mean, I think overall the idea is when we talked about it to a couple of days ago, to not see it as a condition, as something, a deficit, but as a talent or as something that has an opportunity if people have the right context for it, if they have an environment where they can thrive. And not being like in the same environment as everyone, where it's maybe too loud for them or too hectic or too strict or too open or so. They would need to would have some kind of special needs, not in order to survive, but in order to thrive. So it's not exactly some kind of disability, but it's a way of potentiality that's being opened or not, probably more along the lines. And it sounds like it's not exactly an easy or simple topic to talk about. It's people who are maybe not even aware of it. It's more attributed to children and not so much to grown-ups. So I guess a lot of grown-ups maybe don't know that they are neurodivergent or in which way or what that means. So maybe they are using a lot of like energy to hide it or to work around it. And it's, as you said, it's also still connected with some shame or stigmatas. It's not exactly what you'd like to discuss with your employer and with your HR person or with the organization you work in or with your colleagues maybe. And at the same time in the whole like as you said awareness of diversity, equality and inclusion, there is more awareness and there is maybe an idea already in organizations to want to create a good work environment and as we say make use or help people thrive in their specific needs and environment. But how can we address those topics that are highly personal at some stage and not so easily discussed? And what does neuro inclusion actually mean in the end of the day? A lot of questions.
They're very questions, and I don't think there's any simple answers. I think that's part of the start of the question, and part of that is because there's a level to it which is a much, much bigger cultural relationship to difference in how people tick and how people are wired. And so I think, if we were living in a culture where just in general there wasn't stigma attached, there wasn't shame attached, there wasn't in general where we think first about the advantages before the challenges. And I don't want to sort of only paint a picture of neurodiversity as just superpowers. Like there are really, really difficult challenges that come with it. But if that was a bigger cultural relationship to it, then I think obviously that would reflect within the smaller context of a company, or of the business world in general. It's still smaller than the whole of culture. So I think there's that level. Which makes it difficult. In terms of what it would look like, the thing that I think is a very good way in is to start with the lowest hanging fruit, which if you're a HR professional, if you're a diversity, equity, inclusion person within a company, try to find out who already is neurodivergent and who already is quite up for talking about it. Because there probably is at least one person somewhere who is and knows and is quite happy to talk about it. And I think to really work from there, it's a lot about, like I said, about personalization. So having these kind of big top-down things isn't considered best practice. Like, a lot of the best practice is really like, can we get the people who are neurodivergent to say, to tell us what they need? And then we try and start there. And then gradually to just kind of expand that to their being a general feeling of like, oh, like, I've just found out I've got ADHD. Great, I'll tell my HR person because they're really happy to know about it. And I think that's really like the way in, I think, to this topic. But it's a difficult one because there's no easy strategy that you can just go, okay, just go ahead and implement this.
Mm.
And if someone were to ask me what would be like a metric I would recommend to a company, it would be that 15% of your employees has told you that they're neurodivergent and they feel happy to tell you.
Mm.
And that you've created an environment where that's actively welcomed. I mean, okay, maybe not everyone, not everyone wants to disclose, and if someone really doesn't want to, then that's also their choice. But I think where everyone who could disclose would be happy to. But I think there's this other layer which you mentioned, which is the people who are undiagnosed, the people who maybe aren't aware. And I think there, that's also, well, there's two aspects to this. So I think if the people who are kind of neurodivergent and proud and are happy to sort of fly that flag and wear that badge, I think that sets a positive example for people who are going like, oh, maybe it's worth checking this out for myself. The other thing though is the curb effect. So, you make a neuroinclusive environment for people who are neurodivergent, and the advantage is that then it generally, the outcome seemed to be that it tends to be better for everyone. So, having like the right balance of order and chaos, about being able to sort of, have some level of choice. Am I in a very like hectic environment now? Am I in a very calm environment? There's many, many, many layers of examples I could give. Who doesn't benefit from that? Who doesn't benefit from going, okay, today I feel like I really need a bit of that crazy energy, and then the next day I need a bit of the calm energy.
Yeah.
I think everyone benefits from having those possibilities.
Of course, which is of course also not so easy in an organization with a lot of people to create the exact fitting in our environment for everyone, for every person there. I was even thinking, when I think back to the time where I was an employee, if I would have felt, well, comfortable to talk about, I'm dyslexic and actually I really suffer in this big office where it's so loud and where people always want me to do like a lot of things at the same time. I'm actually not really able to do that. I need to like have one thing after the other. I need a calm environment. I need it quiet to be able to focus and stuff like that. I don't think so. But in general, I think maybe it would be enough in order to create something that's neuroinclusive, that people don't even have to have a diagnosis or have to like disclose their diagnosis that they're having, but maybe start to feel and sense, what is it that I need in order to thrive?
Mm-hmm.
And that then this would be a possibility that there's a flexible environment where that's possible. for everyone, maybe even for people who are not
Yeah.
neurodivergent, there are some people who are more sensitive, but some people are more outgoing. I mean, there are so many, everybody's so different and everybody has so different ways of needing an environment to thrive. That maybe then also the neurodivergent people
Right, yes.
would suddenly say, okay, what I'm needing, it's okay to need something different than
Yes.
what's being offered to me. And
Yes,
also to
exactly.
say, you know, if only I had this or that, I would thrive so much more. That's why some people are thriving in the home office and some really suffer. Some
Yeah.
really, really need other people around them. And they thrive in a little bit of chaos and hectic and noise. And other ones are so much happier. If this has something to do with neurodivergence, I don't know. But definitely they operate differently. I think that's safe to say. And you
Yeah,
can see
absolutely.
that changing environments bring about very different responses in different people.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
But we're
Yeah.
talking here specifically about, I mean, if we talk about, sorry, if we talk about the, I don't know, the autism spectrum, there we could maybe really have something that's even more specific than I need a little bit of this or I need more of that. They maybe would need specific jobs.
A lot of it's about the job description. You know, if you're that really outgoing person, then doing something where you're stuck in a back office is not going to be great. I mean, that's kind of like that's sort of easy enough to say without needing to go into brain function. I think the brain function level of it brings another layer to it, because then it often gets a bit more extreme. So looking at the kind of introversion, extroversion, personality thing, people with ADHD tend to, not always, but tend to have that like very people oriented, like getting a lot of juice from the interaction. So it's a lot of the people who really suffered during the lockdowns. It's like, if you're alone at home with ADHD, that's, for a lot of people with ADHD, that's really hard. I think a lot of the people who, and autism is sort of, in a sense, often, again, not always, I don't want to generalize, but overgeneralize, tends to be a bit more like preferring that predictable routine. Social interactions can be quite strenuous. So, you know, I think sort of if you take those things to the extreme, it's like the people who, I think a lot of the people on the autism spectrum who then went into home office and could be like, okay, I can just do my tasks without like all these people around me, and it can make my routine as I want to make it. I think a lot of them did really well in the home office kind of thing. But, you know, again, overgeneralizing, always got to take every single thing with a pinch of salt. There was something else that you said, that will come to me.
Yeah. I mean, we could talk a little bit about the role of leadership in that context, and if it would make sense to create some offerings specifically for leaders so that they can, first of all, maybe see for themselves if there's something there that they need, and also make them a little bit more sensitive for the needs of the employees without giving them, you know, a list of this person who has this. We don't want to do like a, as you say, kitchen diagnosis of employees, but simply make them aware that it could be that there are there's a high probability that you have neurodivergent people in your team. And even if it's not open or talked about, maybe there are certain offerings they could do just because they have become more conscious of it, more aware, and can act maybe more intentional or more empathetic, even compassionate and understanding, and not being impatient with people or thinking they, or make them wrong, or like stress them more than necessary.
Yeah. I remembered what it was that I wanted to say, which I think does connect to what you just asked. So hiding your weirdness, whether one feels like you have to hide, whether you feel like you have to hide your weirdness or not. And the technical term is masking. So if you're an employee and you're working somewhere and you're having to put a lot of your energy into masking, that's energy that you're not able to put into doing what you're there to do. So yeah, creating space for weirdness, that people can bring a bit more of their weirdness to work with them.
Yeah,
I think that's a lot of what neuroinclusion comes down to. But then you're asking about the role of leadership. So there's a study I found, I can't remember what it is, I think it's or where I found it even, it's one of those things I stumbled across and then should have saved. Anyway, it was maybe a little out of date now, but it's looking at neurodivergence in the workforce. And what they found was, if you go into sort of the entry level employees, you have a fairly like, the amount of neurodivergence within the workforce was fairly representative of the general population.
Like 15%.
Exactly. If you go to the executive level, it jumps up to something like over 50%.
Oh, wow.
So at the executive level, there's a lot of this need for big picture thinking and to be thinking in terms of strategies, being able to think in terms of strategies rather than to find details. But then middle management was something like less than 1% were neurodivergent. So it's this kind of like normal, like overrepresented and then like heavily underrepresented. So I think this is a really interesting phenomenon in terms of, it's often the middle management that sort of that is, well, they're between the sort of the day-to-day employee and the executives. So that's why a lot of neurodivergent people then start their own businesses, because they're like, well, I can create the work environment I need to thrive, and I don't have to hide it here. It's a big, I mean, this is a big problem, like, how, because in a sense that sort of layer where it's very heavily underrepresented is the layer that, the talent pool is, the talent can't rise up so easily. So have the role of leadership in terms of leading the way and creating a neuroinclusive environment. I think this really connects a lot to how you work and with Conscious Consultancy Group. I think this thing about, like, you start with that on the leadership level, if they can start to say, okay, well, what about me? What is my weirdness? What is my cognitive weirdness that I don't bring to work? And what is my learning journey been like, and how have I got to where I am, and what are the cognitive differences that have challenged me and also forced me to find a solution. So I think working with, like, maybe I've got some brain thing going on. I think for the leadership level to work on that is really good, because I think the trickle down effect is something that you really see in these organizations where it's very well known the founder had this or this condition, and where there's a strong culture of not in spite of but because of. And I think, the Virgin Group is a very good example of this. Richard Branson having been so vocal about it. I think that trickle down is potentially very powerful.
I can remember we once did an exercise with a whole organization where people asked themselves, starting with the core leadership team, and I gave them just two simple questions. The whole thing was about empowerment, but we thought empowerment is not a thing, but being powerful is something people can relate to. And we just simply asked them what costs you energy and what gives you energy. And maybe this is a way how we can find out what we need. Like for some people, for me, for example, being around people all the time costs me a lot of energy. For other people, it is exactly what gives them energy. And stuff like this. So this is how we found out that people actually have very, very different needs and very different ways of what is exhausting for them and what's enriching and empowering for them. And it's somehow helped by opening up and giving feedback, not about you, but about myself, that people could better understand why a certain person acts in a specific way or responds in a specific way that they do. Maybe it has to do with a general climate and culture of, I would say, respect and compassion and tolerance. And understand that other people are different and have different needs on all kind of levels.
Yes, exactly. Exactly.
And probably this is maybe the, let's say, the meta culture for inclusion and diversity and equality. And then we have those specific topics like neurodiversity and neuroinclusion. But we can't have only neuroinclusion and not be inclusive in other topics, right?
Yes, exactly. Exactly. And I think this is where, you know, this is where neuroinclusion isn't a million miles away from good practice diversity inclusion work in general. I think where it gets really interesting, or where there's a kind of added layer of advantage, is where there's an acknowledgement that, I think, firstly, neurodiversity is something that's very invisible. You know, so there's no, it's not like age or gender or well, biological sex, at least. It's not like age and sex and ethnic background, which are things which have these very visible things that you can see, of like, okay, this person's skin color is different, this person looks older, looks younger, you know, those things are very obvious markers of difference. With neurodiversity, it's invisible. It's not something, I mean, unless you're talking about like sort of the more severe cases of autism, where like you can see very clear behavioral tics and things. But if you're sort of talking about like, and this gets controversial, about high functioning, what's low functioning, etc. But if you're talking, stay within the realm of sort of high functioning, then it's not something that you can see. It's not something you look at someone and go, oh yeah, I know that this person has ADHD. You might have to spend a long time to get to know that about them.
Especially as we talk about masking, right?
Exactly.
It would be difficult for me to mask that I'm like a white woman, middle-aged, you know, everybody could see that probably, and then have the ideas about it. But they would probably not see that I'm dyslexic.
Exactly.
Right. And I will try to hide everything that has to do with my dyslexic problems. It would cost me a lot of energy to read out loud without making mistakes, but I can do it, right? Because I'm trained in that. Or not mix up numbers all of the time. One small example is if somebody says me, tells me a telephone number, I need the digits. I can't have like, it's 36, 712, 599 or something.
No.
I need like, it's 3, 2, 1, 5, 7. So it's very, very difficult for me. These are like small things
Yeah.
that people don't really understand that it's really difficult for me if it's like 512 to figure out what it really means.
Yeah, it's like 500, 500. And then by the time you've decoded that, they've got something else and you missed it.
And then it's also difficult for me to figure out that it's probably, I think it's difficult for everyone. That's why I always say numbers like this. But for other people, it's obviously very easy, because otherwise they wouldn't say the telephone number in that very complicated way. Probably yes. For them, it's much easier. If I say 1512367, they get a little bit confused because they're not used to that.
Potentially, you could think about that in terms of the curb effect.
Mm.
So, do you know what I mean by the curb effect? If I say that term,
no, what's that?
So the whole thing is like, you put curbs on the street corners, mm-hmm. To help people with wheelchairs, mm-hmm. and it's like, you know, it's great that people with wheelchairs can now get up and down the curb more easily, but then who else uses it? Kids on scooters, cyclists, like. People who maybe just like they don't need a wheelchair, but their mobility is a bit restricted and like they just don't walk as easily. And there's all these people who benefit from putting a curb in instead of like a hard
edge, yeah.
edge between mm-hmm. the pavement and the road.
Oh, okay.
So yeah. So that's the curb effect. Mm-hmm. So let's say we were to do a scientific study where we find out that remembering that writing down a phone number is easier with individual digits rather than combinations, may or may not be true. Let's say it's true. In you doing that, because you're like, well, this is easy for me, so it must be easier for everyone else, you're actually behaving in a way that's making other people's lives easier and not just mm-hmm. your own.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I mean, it's not such a great example because it's not validated, but if we were to find those kinds of things where it's like, actually, you know what? Doing it this way is easier.
You know,
why are we, why are we beating our head against the wall trying to implement a procedure that actually is difficult and doesn't make sense?
I think we can come to an end now, because I think we could go on forever.
Yeah, absolutely.
I think we are really just at the beginning of this topic. Like neurodiversity, neuro inclusion, I've just started to hear about it a little bit more. And now research, there's anyway a lot of podcasts online, mm-hmm. a lot of resources, but most of them are focused on children, as you say, education
exactly.
and stuff like this. Yeah. There's not so much around and what this could mean possibly for businesses. But probably it's safe to say that to create an open and trusted environment where people feel safe to show up as themselves and mm-hmm. express their needs would be already a very good like first step,
yeah,
to facilitate life for everyone, and especially for people who are neurodivergent. I'm learning the language.
Yeah.
And yeah, what's maybe your like summary of all of that? What is a message you would like to give people who
right,
listen to the
yeah.
podcast?
So the message I'd like to give is that it's great, it's just really awesome to discover people's weirdness and to discover your own weirdness, and the extent that that may or may not be based on a difference in how your brain is wired, that there might be a neurological level underneath that, which is like there. And I think the thing that really excites me is to get into space, a mental space where you're curious about there's curiosity and acceptance for that weirdness with a compassionate humor. I think if I was to boil it down to these things, it'd be like curiosity, acceptance, compassionate humor. And I think this is something where it is really beneficial to be able to have a sense of humor about it for oneself, for others, you know, to be like, oh, it's my distractibility again, you know.
Right.
And to sort of have a warm humor about it. You know, it's not a making excuses, like it's not a beating yourself up. It's just kind of going, okay, this is how things, how, you know, I'm wired in this way, and this is something that is always going to be challenging. And these are things that are always going to be super easy for me that I don't understand why it's hard for other people. And just to have a humor about that. I think that's really what I would, I think a really great thing to embody for oneself. And also, like, who doesn't want to work in a work environment where that's the culture? You know, who doesn't want to work in a work environment where you're like, okay, however I'm wired, condition, no condition, whatever, however I'm wired, I can show up with that.
Yeah, that's beautiful. Let's embrace our weirdness. One last question. The hearts that you have behind you on the wall, did you stick them now specifically for a recording, or is this what you always have there?
I was actually cleaning out today, and I found these post-its and was like, there wasn't quite enough to really do anything with them. So I thought, oh, I'll just put them up on my wall.
That's really sweet.
So there they
Yeah,
are.
very nice. Thank you so much, Sebastian.
It's been such a pleasure.
It was a wonderful conversation, and I'm now really get more and more interested in the topic. So for everyone who listened to the podcast, you could research yourself, and we will also give you some links and recommendations to read more. And we'll put all your contact data. So if you're interested to work with Sebastian as an individual, as a leader, as an organization, you are probably open to that.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And I think you can create all kind of like offerings, like sensitivity trainings and individual coachings and working with groups. And finding out about themselves and creating that kind of context that everyone actually needs. Everyone needs a context, as you say, where we can embrace our weirdness. And yeah, so thank you and see you soon.
Yeah, thank you so much. Thanks for inviting
And
me.
bye.
Yeah, bye-bye.